Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. If you're in wine, you're about to hear a story that will make you feel optimistic for the category. Zeke Bladier and Corey Asink are two longtime wine industry veterans who got sick of watching the wine market go down market. Everywhere they looked, the on-trade in California was splitting into fine wine and truly terrible wine. Not only that, but there were lots of little restaurants that wouldn't touch wine because they couldn't manage the inventory and glassware. In 2022, Zeke and Corey raised money from friends and neighbours and launched Los Cuernos, wines in cans, good wines in cans, and it's exploded. At the time of the interview, they're managing 240 on-trade accounts. Now, it's obvious that what they're doing could be done in other markets, which means there's a big opportunity on the table. I hope you enjoy listening to this interview as much as I enjoyed making it. And don't forget to sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which has recaps plus lots of original content. You'll find it at drinksinsider.com. And if you know somebody who should be on the show, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. Zeke, Corey, it's so great to see you. Can you please introduce yourselves and talk about why you're here? Can you talk about your product? Corey, start with you.
Yeah, awesome to be here. So glad we made it. But yeah, I'm Corey, and Zeke will talk in a second. We're the two co-founders of Los Cuernos Wine. I'll kick it over to him.
Right, Zeke.
That's it. Okay, wow. Yeah, my name is Zeke, co-founder of Los Cuernos Wine. Corey and I are lifer wine people, and the mission of the company is to make great wine more accessible at a fair price.
Okay. All right, let's start with the beginning. How did you meet one another, and when did you decide that the thing that you wanted to launch onto the world was a canned wine?
Yeah, well, in 2001, we met in a fine dining restaurant, both as servers in Long Beach, California, a fancy Italian restaurant, same one where I met my wife. And, you know, we just got into wine.
Who else have you met in that restaurant?
Oh, my gosh. Sounds
amazing.
A lot of Sandra Bullock, Jesse James, Babyface.
What's the restaurant? We all need to go there.
Paul Newman. It's called La Opera on Pine Avenue in Long Beach. It's where it all started. So, but you know, we were already into wine, but that's when we really got into wine in our 20s. Both kind of certified sommeliers, kind of did the whole kind of wine journey. Eventually, at different times, Zeke and I both went to the distributor and supplier side of the wine industry too. So, kind of all forms and facets of the wine industry. And then it was about 13 years ago that we knew we were going to do our own wine. And then, you know, cut to, you know, just over six years ago, Zeke was like, we're going to put it in a can. And I said, absolutely not, is exactly what I said.
Yeah.
That's the clean version. And then, you know, I digress. So
you were about to swear and you stopped yourself and you said, no, we must not put it in a can. No. So what was the impetus? Like, did you wake up one morning and go, must have cans? I mean, or did something happen that make you go, you know, it's time for this product?
Yeah. You know, we loved wine. And if you, one more, at La Opera, the CEO of 100 Acre Landon, he worked there too. So a very wine centric place. So first we wanted to make, even back then, we could tell the wine was going from Napa, Sonoma, and even like great places from France, Italy, and Spain on wine lists to becoming more generic. And the quality was going down.
That's interesting. But, I'm going to stop you there. I'll get back to your story in a second, but what was driving that?
So, this is it. We're going to talk about it.
We're going to talk about it.
Let's go.
So it's really about incentive structure and the three-tier system, and then the baby boomers and the wine industry. So the baby boomers are the largest generation in the history of the United States, and they really came to prominence in the 80s, 90s, 2000s. So the wine industry just chased this consumer all the time, and it drove the wine to certain places. It went to fine dining. It went to like some golf, a lot of restaurants. And you know you have a boom when someone could grab literally any bottle off the street, open it up and pour it. And they're like, yeah, this is house wine. What do you know about it? I don't know. What quality is it? I don't know. So that started happening more. And so even then we were going to do a wine. So we're like, what if we do white blends and red blends? Because some of these undervalued regions, we can put together really good wine and we can make a really good by the glass wine. And, you know, I'll tell you, Corey and I probably have tried, I always say like 10,000 wines each, you know, doing the sommelier journey, the restaurant journey, you're studying day in and out 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 glasses of wine every day, like boom, boom, boom. And then when you go to the distributor in wine sales, we're trying to make another person money with wine. And so you do the gamut. You have fine dining where I'm finding something eclectic from like a deep wine list, you know, Italy, France, whatever. I go to a broad market dive bar. I'm trying to get him something easy. I'm going to a sports bar. I want something that drinks like Dal, La Crema, that, I mean, the women there or the people there are going to like the wine. So I'm getting here somewhere. So we knew kind of the footprint was all going towards one place.
Hang on, you haven't really answered the question of why suddenly did wine become homogenous. Is it because the market broadened too much and so the wine had to please everybody? Okay. Or what was it?
Okay. I like it, Felicia. Push me to give you a really succinct answer.
I want the succinct answer.
Okay.
So I've worked my ass off for this interview. I want the answers.
And so I was stocking shelves at two different liquor stores at 17 years old. I went into restaurants, I went to the distributor, and then I did start. So I've seen the whole evolution. So it really, the baby boomers drew all the money and attention to those places. Since the money was there and why, and then everyone wanted in, wine's a very middleman heavy business. And I don't say it negatively. You have wine spectator, wine enthusiasts, right? You have your distributors that are mandated and you have your retailers that are mandated. So as the power grew to the restaurants and to the distributors, you've seen their margins go up the last 20 years. The people actually made wine didn't have a lot of choices here. So wine never grew the consumer trial mechanism. And this is the biggest point. They're based in Silicon Valley. So if I wanted to grow this water right here in my hand, the first thing I would need is awareness and consumer trial. Those are the first, and a great product. So the great product that wine is, Napa, Sonoma, Italy, France, Germany, Spain, instead we give them, I'm not making fun of it. The most distributed single serves in the United States are Sutter Home and Barefoot and Copa Divino Woodbridge, because those small plastic bottles were the ones at scale could make that profitable. So we just gave a very bad product to a lot of the first time consumers. But if I go get a beer, I can find a great beer in 99% of the restaurants, pay a certain amount, people are going to know about it, and it's great. Wine is, I got to know what's, yeah.
So you're really noticing this happen, 6 or 7 years ago. So this is about the period where distribution channels start to become very consolidated. So if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that they began to use the highest volume wines.
No, but it's two ways. It's really the three-tier system makes us far away from the people that like wine.
Right.
So it really started in 2015. And I was watching it. There was a restaurant in downtown San Diego. I sold in all the wines. They had 4 reds, 4 whites, and 2 sparklers. I go to Chicago, move back 2 years later. They have 2 wines, and it's Robert Mondavi Private Select.
But why? Why that narrowing?
Yeah, so what happened was, as the distributor reps were competing and all the wines went to the same accounts, they started competing each other. We didn't grow any new consumers. So we're all fighting over the same consumers, but you have way more wine people going there. And so now the retailer's like, you know what? And then costs are going up. So I can't pour Napa Sonoma. It's cost $14.16. I'm going to pour Central Coast for $10. And now I got away with that. Now I'm going to pour California. Right. Now I'm just going to pour some no-name wine, and I'm still making money off of it. And so because it was profitable, that was why it kept working. Oh, let's go one more here. The big one here. restaurants, if you think about you had a restaurant that had a $100 check, right? $80 in food, $20 in beverage. They probably, a great restaurant, $15 to $20 gross profit. Half of the 80s through the 90s and 2000s, you added a bottle of wine for $100 more and you paid $24 or $40. You made $60 gross profit. That system is hard to wean yourself off of.
Yeah.
My brother worked for cable television for a long time, and they knew that on-demand was coming. They knew streaming was coming, and they couldn't stop it. And I feel that way with the wine industry. We were watching this slow-motion car wreck, and we're like, dude, they won't activate the consumer trial. They won't do kegs. They won't do single serve. I'm going to these cool little restaurants, and you're giving me barefoot. And then I see cool craft cocktails. And I see cool beers, and I'm like, wine is blowing it. And it
yeah, I've told this story lots of times, but in late 2023, I went with a girlfriend to a conference in Washington, and we were staying right in the center of Washington. And I judged the bulk wine competition in Amsterdam some years, and I can tell 70 cents a liter, right? I know what it tastes like. Yeah. And I was being served 70 cents a liter wine at $15 a glass. And eventually... Yeah. I just started drinking gin and tonic. I mean, it was disgusting. Yeah. And we got on the plane and my friend said to me, now I know why people in the US aren't drinking wine anymore, because it's just really poor quality and bad value.
Yeah. So Felicity, you nailed it. It's all tied together with the consumer trial mechanism, like Zeke mentioned, and what you're referring to. Because of the historical margins of on-premise restaurants, they're largely based on the inefficiency of the bottle, which makes you can commit to 4.5 servings. Think about this, Felicity. Next time you're in a restaurant, you're at the bar, you look over the back bar, and you see bottles of wine with like corks or stoppers in them. It's suboptimal product, and you could say it's just stale product. You would never order a burger that was sitting on the expo line for 6 hours.
That's true.
So in addition to that, because of the absurd kind of margin profile, that, I mean, you know, Zeke and I, all sides of the business. So we were buyers, won a Wine Spectator Award at a fine dining Italian spot too. So I was guilty.
I'm going to put that all over the show notes. That'll bring listeners in.
so yeah, it was great. But like, you know, everybody knows it's like 4 to 5x. You make the bottle cost back in the first glass. These are things people still have just been brainwashed with, and it's based on the inefficiency of the bottle. So for us, and I'm going to try to bring this full circle. Another one of the pieces of the impetus of us doing this is after we would get off, the sommelier floor, we were hungry. We'd go get a burrito, whether it was a burger bar or, you know, a taco shop or whatever. And we would always see, you could always get a good craft beer, especially here in Southern California. You can always get a good RTD, spirit based, whatever, High Noon, Cutwater. Wine, it was never there. Or it was just the little crappy plastic bottles. And that is, and that's really it. So the consumer never had, you know, the boomers had like, hoarded the wine for so long that they just lost generations. And we love wine. And so we wanted to do something about it.
I still haven't quite got this connection between the boomers and why wine went to shit. Is it because they started to leave the market?
They made it too complicated.
I feel like I'm running a classroom, so listeners can't see this, but I've got two people on either side of me raising their hands going, can I talk this? So Zeke, you're... Go ahead, Zeke.
So when industries fail, it's because of stakeholder misalignment. And so there's four stakeholders in industry: the suppliers who make the wine, right? The customers, actually, let's go in order here. Suppliers, distributors, retail, customers. The boomers being such a large generation, I worked for these companies. You know, in fact, at Southern, I got to see all their wine plans every year. Moet, Dom, Fuflico, Chalon, and then at Young's. We sold all the wines, sold Bordeaux's. It was just more profitable. So they optimized. So if you looked at an account networked and I saw... let's go Los Angeles, perfect market. I'm going to go to the coast and I'm going to go to the suburbs and I'm going to go to the golf courses. I'm going to go to those affluent neighborhoods and I'm going to get a crazy return on it. Beer, started losing in the 80s and 90s because of the French paradox, the 60 minutes thing, which Rose won. They're like, screw this. We're getting our butts kicked in here. All the money is being made by the distributors. We're going to go put kegs and fresh wine into breweries, pizzerias. And they got out a bunch of customer trial. I go out now and I see beer just kicking wine's butt. Like, just like Corey, I'm around a lot and I'm embarrassed because I know some of these women and men don't want to drink beer. They really want to drink wine, but it's so gross. So that misalignment kept going.
And so now what you're really talking about is that wine went through a kind of enchidification process
that we've seen in tech. Oh my gosh.
Yes. I love it.
So basically they got away with saying you have to start at very mediocre wine and earn your way up to the top shelf. That worked for many years and it doesn't. And my last rant on this, because this was in 2010, they let me go to almost any account at Southern Glazers. You can ask them 2011, any account they felt I could go on in SoCal, I could just walk in with the team and meet and sign up. It's not all of them. And I said to them, I go, we're in downtown Disney. I had all the hotels and the Disney Resort. I go, there's a bunch of family restaurants around here. This Thai place, I know them. They're selling wine in there. We could probably get 4 or 5 cases a month. Easy, no competition. They told me not to do it. They're like, no, you're too good. Go to the fine dining place. Go here. And then I'm like, the sports bar. And so
was that a kind of contempt for the consumer, or were they going the margins up high enough?
It was just profit optimization. Right. Now let's go to the account level. This happened to me too. 15 years ago, I would tell someone, he's like, hey, I need my house wine. I want one for $2. And I go, look, man, I'm gonna be totally honest with you. If you buy this one for $5, right? $2 wine, 50 cents a pour he's selling for $6 or $7. I go, for $5, you charge one more. The experience is so much better and your food's amazing. And he's like, I don't care. I got to make my margin. And he didn't understand. So like that, all of those stakeholders, the restaurants who didn't care, the distributors who didn't care. Now the industry is downturning.
And to go one step further, that's awesome, Zeke. Felicity, one step further. This is deep, as you know.
Yeah.
This is Drinks Insider. Inside.
But when you really think about it, all what Zeke's saying is true. But then you look at, you know, he was talking about how the traditional wine and spirit distributors, the accounts they would go to and focus on to optimize profit in the short term. Well, and then all of a sudden you blink and years later, the wine and spirit distributors have like settled in to like their footprint, which is, and then beer, you know, there became this large bifurcation of distributors, the beer network and the wine and spirit distribution network. Yeah. Very, very different. And it's based on originally what they were going for. So for example, all the small restaurants, all the convenience, that's where the beer network was just optimized, you know, the smaller orders, you know, more the touch points. And then wine and spirits was just making the money at all the fancy places and kind of got fat and happy. Well, now everybody knows it's all about, you know, convenience for the customer and single serve. And so now everybody wants that. The wine and spirits industry is shaking in their boots now.
Right. This is a good moment to go back to why I'm interviewing you in the first place, which is that you have a nice wine in a can. So all of this horrible stuff is going on. And what was the moment that you go, I'm sick of this. Let's go out and start our own product.
Oh, I am so pumped. So we had talked about this. The first time we went to a Custom Crush, 2007 or 2008, and we walked with the winemaker and we saw him do it. And I thought it was going to be the most hardest thing ever. And I'm like, oh, there's a formula here. We need money, buy this, do this, do this output. And so we talked about it, learning, going through our career and then getting close. But here was the moment for me. It was the 2019 and 2020, the bank report, the wine,
Silicon Valley the pandemic. Bank report. It was the bank report, Silicon Valley Bank.
And I remember reading, it was 920, and they said the fastest growing wine consumer was the 70s-year-old people. So that just meant that these people that were like retiring, that had a lot of income, were increasing consumption. We were losing in every single one. And I think I texted her, I called them, I go, dude, they're blowing it. Like, we're like annoyed. And that is, I remember that moment thinking to myself, they're blowing it. If I want to get good wine, it's only in certain places and it's overcharged. That's why there's a big D2C. And so Corey and I decided like we were really going to go do it. And then
again, what's the link between old people drinking, people over 70s, and you going, they've blown it?
Yeah, it's about consumers. Is they were gifted this amazing product. It's naturally low carb. It's naturally low sugar. Red wine is actually shelf stable and it doesn't need refrigeration. But because they made, and they didn't mean to, but as a company, they're just a big company. They're just trying to extract from that. And they never came back and grew the customers. That is, to me, blowing that. If you were in charge of wine the last 20 years and you're one of the top four companies, this may hurt your feelings. You guys were the losers. Like spirits grew and beer grew and you guys were in charge. So like in sports, if you were in charge, you blew it. And so here's what we're doing. We're trying to, sorry, I'm fired up, but bring consumer trial back.
You can be fired up.
Yeah. So
bring quality back.
Yeah. Like part of this Felicity, it deals with like the complication of it in innovation. So if we take a step back and we look at some of these other categories like beer and spirits, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you couldn't find a craft beer in a can. Right now, you can't find one not in a can. The beer industry figured it out. It's about freshness with the can and the keg. The wine industry has made everything so complicated. Sure, it's steeped in tradition. We love tradition. We love bottled wine. We always will. But at the end of the day, it's not all it is, right? Meanwhile, everybody else is like so far ahead of the game. I mean, hell, we drink water out of cans now. And then all of a sudden, like I find myself stuffing a bottle of wine in my golf bag or trying to like somehow bring like stems and glasses to like a tailgate. It's like, what are we doing? And so,
all right. So we go back to this moment. That what was the moment that you go, you know what, let's go and start a canned wine brand. Okay. Do you remember what it was? And when was it?
Yeah. Yes, it was December of 2022. And by then, like the industry had gotten even worse. And I was like, and then I had told, we had decided we were going to do it in cans. So to finish that story, Corey said, absolutely not. And slept on it for like a day or two. And I was like, just think about it, man. Like, and the truth was the bottle footprint is so well defended. They have giant supply chains full of bottles, giant supply chains works. They have the distribution network and the retailers together. So in order to do that, that was not going to happen. And so we decided if we were going to try to help grow wine again, we were going to do it through cans. And so it was that month in December. I remember I sent an email to my boss saying I would like to stop working in May. Please, I was a chief commercial officer. I'll tell you something crazy, Felicity, and very few people know this. I interviewed with, this was Final Bell Holdings. We had like 300 employees. We're doing $150 million, $170 million, $200 million. And I told the main three guys, this is my last job before I start the wine company that I'm going to start.
Okay, because what you've told me so far, right?
Yes.
You go, in 2007, I saw this, and then I read this in 2019, and then it was 2022. So you don't come across like somebody who does something impulsively. Like, that's a really long time. And then you go, and you know what? And then I told the guy, I'm out. I'm going to be unemployed.
Well, it's so funny. Like, I mean, we're going to walk a stupid. Wine kind of changed my life. And so even in the industry, we're keeping up with it and we're knowing. And to be honest, I probably just wasn't confident enough to do it at the time periods or felt like I could. And like slight of really good at the distributor engine team.
All right. So Corey, yes. Did you also throw in your job and go home and go, I'm unemployed now? Or did you, were you more cautious?
No, we.
You did.
No, Zeke's kind of like, you know, he was talking about just before 2023 where that was the moment, but we had already decided like this is years and years of, I mean, the real reason is we told people we were going to start our own wine company for years and years. And people were like, do it already. No, they were like, yes. Like, because they knew it was going to happen. So for us, it was like, it was literally just not having access to good wine. And then, kind of transitioning just a...
You just blew it. One day your top just blew and you went, we're out.
Yeah.
So, okay. So starting a wine company, even small, even with lots of contacts and stuff, is expensive. Where did you get the money from? Was this savings or did you crowdfunding?
Oh my God. This is going to be the full real story. Yeah. I don't think no one's ever asked us this part about it. So I knew that time. I end up, my last day of work was March 30th, 2023. That's the last time I got a paycheck from somebody else. And here we go, Felicia. We had $0 raised and I had no job.
So you're a curious combination of, procrastination and then sort of just impulsivity.
Because I knew 4 months ago I was going to do it. So we had started meeting at my house on the weekends. We started registering the company. We started looking, and it wasn't fair to my old employee to like do both. And I remember this moment, whatever, how this sounds. I said, if you really believe you're a great salesperson and this thing's going to work, then you're going to sell investors on it. And so I quit my job and so we started raising money.
How? Did you go to people you knew or did you? Yes. What did you do?
First three investors, it's kind of crazy and emotional. My neighbor in Illinois, I got promoted out to Illinois for 2 years, 2.5 years from San Diego. Great food city, people city. And my neighbor, I told him, I said, hey, one day I'm going to do this wine company, blah, blah, blah. I moved back to San Diego. I moved back in 18. So I told him in 17, I believe, I moved back to San Diego and I call him in 2023 and he writes us our first check.
How much how much did you raise? Yeah,
initially? So it was $100,000.
You lived in a nice neighborhood. If I went to my neighbors and said, give me some money, I'd be lucky to get 20 euros.
He is such an unbelievably great human being. Like, I let him watch my kids. I met him. He just came and started helping me doing yard work. Like, he's insane. He was the first one. And then the next two were my mentor, Bob Robbins. He is what's his title? He's the COO at Provi, the largest wine spirits marketplace that's not owned by a company. Southern Glazers is the largest one. And then, so I met Bob in 2014 at Jim Beam, told him that we were going to do a wine company in 2014 or 15. Him and I worked together twice, had a lot of success. And so he is an investor as well. And then the third one was Larry Seal. When I got my first vice president job, they didn't trust me. So they gave me an executive coach. It's true.
They did give you $100,000.
but he did some wonders with me. I had a lot of success thanks to Larry and those two other people. And he said something super cool. And this was, again, 16, 17. He goes, when you start the wine company, if you don't let me invest, I will never talk to you ever again. And true to his word, he did it. So that money, I'll tell you, so crazy. We got product to market with $250,000.
Yeah. Okay. So what happens? So you've got your check. Yeah. You've got it in the bank. What happens next? I mean,
we go.
Go. So did you already know who your canning line was going to be? Did you know who you were going to buy from? Did you know who was going to produce the wine? Like, did you have all of that lined up?
So we had done startups. And so we understood a lot of the things. We understand products. So during that 3 months before I quit on the weekends, we got a lot of that out and going. But it got to the point where it was like real. And then, I had to quit. So the crazy part is we're signing up like these deals with these people and we have no money. We need this. We need the grapes. This. Okay. Sounds great. And, so we had all the package. I think the biggest and largest fear in my mind was the wine. And so Corey and I are experts at wine.
Not the I've quit my job and I've got no money. No. That was not the fear.
Because as someone that has served wine to thousands of people, like finding out, trying to make them have a great experience with wine, whether it's $20 a bottle, whether it's $5,000, and then as a distributor person that was very trusted in super fine dining and casual dining to give something that would make them money. So if the wine tasted like a $10 or a $14 bottle, but sold for $10, I knew it, I would tell her, hey, we're going to go this up and down the street. If it's the converse, and it's a it sounds 14 and tastes like a 10. As a wine person, I would tell them the truth. Go, hey man, this ain't that good. You know, we'll work something out, sell it over here. But this was going to be our brand. And I was like, if this taste doesn't taste like what we thought would be, then this whole thing, I'll give the money back.
Did you already have distribution set up? Like, did you have people who said, yeah, I'll try your wine?
No.
Okay. No. So you had to.
Yeah. So Felicity, it's, oh my gosh. So I'm going to take one step back. We originally, a lot of this takes, obviously it takes guts. It takes some naivety too. You know, there's, you know, I digress. And when we originally started, we actually had, we had somebody commit $1 million. And then in a blink of an eye, that million turned into 100K, but we had already decided. So this is the hardest thing times, I don't even know, exponentially the most hardest thing we've ever done in our life that we can't even get across. But we knew we had to go. So to be totally honest, we're just closing our friends and family, our first seed round right now. And, you know, and we've raised $1.4 million to date, which from where we are is still like unheard of. So it's been the most gnarly journey could ever imagine.
Yeah,
let's try
to skip, Corey, because I feel like we're going to take so much time in the beginning story. But so we met Gerard. I want to go quickly, and then we could talk about a lot of the go-to-market. And at least it's your podcast, so if you like what I'm talking about, but we have so much. So that
let me go back to my question. So I'll start directing this like a proper podcast host. Yeah. Okay, so you've got some money. You've quit your jobs. You know, you've got your contacts in wine and you've got your canning and so on. So what was your first variety?
So we knew the wines that we thought would do well. And by the way, the last 20 years before to 15 years, I'm trying wines all the time and trying people to get this profile. So the first one we picked was a rosé. There's a big rosé set in most stores. It was a growing category. We added bubbles to it, thinking that it's more occasions and most people just love a bubbly. And so we decided we're going to do rosé. Second one, and this is where my mistake was, Felicity, is we did Chard because of just the dominance of sales. We felt like we could make a really good one, approachable, easy wine. The wine we wanted the most for us was a red wine in a can that drank like a full-bodied red wine.
Which is the hardest thing to put into a can.
Yeah.
That is the absolute most difficult one for a can.
We cracked it, and then we didn't want one thin. And then the fourth wine, because I wasn't sure about how we were going to do the quality, because I tried almost all of the canned wines, and that was another deciding factor. I was blown away by how most of them were very poor and bad experiences, not thoughtful, just quick money grabs or just bad quality.
All right. So you've got your product, but now you have to go to market. So who was the first person that said, yes,
I was going to finish that. We did the Reserva wine, and we made a $45 bottle basically in a can. That can sells for $15 because I wanted Corey and I to have a really good wine.
We did some things
differently about like how we make the wine. One of them is we went non-vintage. So Felicity, you'll get this, but think of it like our wine, but specifically the Reserva and the Red Blend, as properly aged and finished wines that are. And when I say properly aged, I mean traditionally, like in French oak barriques and in barrels. And when people look at the can, it's hard for them to see it like that. But it is just real wine. Sure, there's some nuance to it because of the vessel. The can is a complete seal. The bottle, you know, the cork is porous. So that, not to get into the weeds, but that reason alone, there's some nuance to it. But other than that, you can put the most amazing wine in a bottle and the shittiest wine in a bottle. It goes for any vessel, right? And so funny, somehow we believed we could do this without being winemakers. So when we identified, we had settled on Petite Syrah the grape strategically, very similar, full-bodied, great fruit, great structure, without the price point, right? Before it got super cool. So we settled on Petite Syrah from Lodi. We identified kind of this amazing award-winning winemaker, young guy, who was like, you know, third generation. And we literally cold called him. And I'll fast forward to us talking him into, letting us fly up there and talk to him. One of the first things he told us was, well, he thought we were crazy. And then 2 hours later.
I think you're crazy.
two hours later, he got
just
it.
Just to be clear.
Touche. And he tells the story much better than us, but he thought we were crazy. And then he's like, okay, I know these guys are legit. And he got it. But even still, he said something. And I'll never forget it. He said, just matter of fact, it is impossible to make a real red wine in a can. And it just, to my core, I was like, I just don't understand. Here's this guy is. It's all he knows. It's what he does. He's such a pro. And then what we realize and what he realized is that it's based on what he had seen. It just hadn't existed, you know, because whatever was in market was largely low quality, little light red, some fizzy stuff, and just nothing substantial or that, you know, you and I would ever consider like a real wine. And then, you know, he spent the next year, you know, proving himself wrong, and he got the bug. And, you know, turns out, I mean, we're still very, very new, emerging brand. And it's just,
Okay. So, I mean, you've got loads of money from your neighbor. You've got your thing. You've got your winemaking. How did you land your first account? Was this somebody that you already knew, or was it cold calling? What did you do?
Yeah, I think our first ones were our relationships. There were some liquor stores that we knew, and those were kind of easier to do, but those weren't like the big deal. The big account for us was an early one called Gonzo Ramen, and he didn't carry wine. Gonzo Ramen, he's been on the top 50 Yelp 3 years in a row. It's like two blocks from the ocean. It's a counter service style, mm-hmm. and it's a really vibey, cool, happening place. And Corey knew his son from the gym. So this was like kind of how we did. We sit down and we had the product for about 2 or 3 months, and it wasn't like doing great. So we had got some things, but we hadn't gotten a lot of sales. And so we wanted to try it out in his restaurant, and we gave him a long pitch, and he kind of said no in the middle. And I was thinking like, Corey, I thought this is your friend. Like, what's going on?
It was so.
And he's like, I want to say my last part. I'll head back.
Nobody's your friend when it comes to money, as one of my friends used to say.
At the last moment, he said, you know what? I'm going to do it for you guys, but I don't think it's going to work.
Right.
And he tried bottles before, the glasses, the wine openers, the moving around in a tight, cool ramen place, like Japanese style restaurant. So he brings us in, and immediately it just starts working in his account, and the customers love it, and he's getting reorders. And
so let me just stop you. Is this because, you know, the servers pour it in a glass? Do the customers know it's out of a can, or are they given the can and they just like it?
They're given the can. Yeah, that's it. They're given the can. And it's so crazy to me that he was even hesitant, and because he has great food, great beverage program, curated great beers. They even do a collab with a local San Diego brewery, great sake. Everything else, but he didn't have wine because in his mind it was too complicated. He literally told us all the education, we don't know about it. I don't even have, you know, the glassware. I can't even fit it in my dishwasher, like spatial stuff operationally. It was too fussy. He's like, forget it. Baby out with the bathwater.
Stupid question, but were people just drinking it in normal glasses? Were they drinking out of the can? Or what's the – how do you get around the glassware?
That's a great question. And we see it – like think about neighborhoods that have demographics of parents, of young people, of older people, of seniors. So it depends on kind of the neighborhood. Definitely if you just give it to them, most will just drink it. And they'll be like, oh, the wine's really good. Some people will just say, I got to have a glass. And so at that point, they'll give them a plastic cup. But – we've built some incentive structure for his account is that he doesn't have to use glassware and cups. So he loves us, and we're bringing him all these new customers, because this is the bigger part, Felicity, is like, think about Uber and Airbnb. The cars were there. The houses were there. The wine drinkers, Southern California is the largest and most profitable wine market in the world. I've sold all over it. The wine drinkers are there. They're only going to Costco, Trader Joe's, and these fancy restaurants. Once they know they can get it in other places and cheaper and it's convenient and it's where other people are at right now, that is going to be something new to wine. And that's going to be how we grow
it. That's really interesting. So did he see a bounce? And did he see a new style of customers emerging, or what happened? You're both nodding.
Yes. I mean, think about it like this. In these counter service restaurants, what we tell them is what he experienced. You are leaving money on the table. It's incremental revenue. We're bringing new customers and new profit to you. He didn't have wine, even though he could legally sell it. Wine is a $70 billion industry. We've been entrenched in this, so it seems so simple and practical to us. But when you're not used to it, I mean, we could still go up and down the coast here and find all these restaurants that have amazing food. They have the ability to sell beer and wine, and they choose only to sell beer because they're scared and/or they don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Are you selling it? Does this mean you have to just sell it account by account and convince everybody?
The only way.
It's
the only way. It's the only way. So even though we come from the distributor side, we come from the largest distributors, and we did amazing there. And we originally, or at least me, naively, when we launched, I was like, oh, we'll for sure end up signing with Southern Glazers, you know, one of the biggest in the country, because they're family to us. Man, nobody, no. That's for another day there. But it was the biggest struggle. And to really build a brand, thankfully, as insiders, we have a lot of insight, is there's no easy way. It starts in the field. It starts on the ground. And so we got, literally going one by one, just to what you said, account by account, we got our distribution up to 100 accounts in San Diego on our own.
Are you allowed to distribute by yourself, being a producer?
We used like a third party platform to help us out. Like there's ones like called LibDib.
You do the sale, yep, and then LibDib fulfills it. I interviewed Marion Leitner-Waldman, who sells Archer Roos, and she said she went with a beer distributor. Have you considered doing that?
That's what we did.
That's what we are doing.
That's what you did. Okay, tell me about the beer distributor.
So if you think about it, like in Coors Being Kind, we were very good salespeople, designing go-to-market strategies and like shelf management, all that stuff. So that's part of why it works. So we got up to 100 with just both of us. And we have
100 accounts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Al says Corey sold the majority of them, not me. He did.
That's what we do.
He was doing it. But
who raised the most money?
Oh, Zeke.
So you're evening out there's no freeloaders on the team. You're both pulling.
He was the best man at my wedding almost 21 years ago. Yeah. We are like opposites, and when I mean opposites, I mean extremely complimentary. But
yeah,
go ahead, Zeke.
Google Corey Osling acting reel. Corey can act, he can sing, he can dance, he can draw. And I'm like doing
it. Okay, apparently he can also sell to accounts. So you've got a hundred accounts.
Yes, let's go here.
Is this a point at which you start thinking we've got to get salespeople? Like what happens when you start getting this big?
You know what? So we were really good at the distributor, and we're really good one-on-one salespeople and how to set up the distributor. So we knew that it was just too much, just two of us. And we went to a lot of distributors, and there was a lot going on in California, so it was tough. And we went with Brown Bag in San Diego. It's a small woman-owned local distributor. And they called on a lot of the smaller accounts that we like. So we had to talk them into it. They're like, oh no, they have really cool craft beers. They have some canned cocktails. But all the wine was pretty gross. She'll admit it.
But you've sorted that out. So on behalf of the wine industry, thank you very much.
They were selling a can for like $1.75 or $2. Ours is $5 each wholesale, and the account sells it for more. So they were nervous about the price and the wine. So this is what we're good at. We worked in the field with them. We trained them. We spent a lot of time in the accounts. We ask them, what is your hardest account? Let's go. We'll walk into that one with you. And so it's cool. You have these guys who've done it a lot, and we're teaching all these young kids, and they have started crushing. So they started out with 100. I think we're up to probably 240 in San Diego. And listen, these are all independent operators, and we're gaining a bunch of consumer trial.
Let me ask you a question. Okay, so it's great that you've got all these really small things, but at what point is it not profitable to go for a really small, like at what point does it cost you in terms of sales time and replenishment and so on and chasing accounts, because small people often don't pay on time?
So let's, this is a great question. And I think our competitors will listen to this too. But Corey, I'm going to say it.
Let it rip.
People that have a lot of money in the industry and they like wine, they want to come in, they're going to grab a celebrity, they're going to grab a chef, they're going to pay to go into the chains. And so what they're going to do is they're going to say, hey, big chain, I'm going to guarantee you a certain markup if you just put my product on the shelf, and I'm going to do a bunch of advertising. So they're going to hope that someone comes and pours their four bottle serving off the shelf in the middle of all those wines, right? Oh, man, I just lost my train of thought there. Sorry, wait.
My question was, when does it become unprofitable to chase lots of accounts?
Perfect. So our whole thing was leveraged on getting the distributor going. So now they grew. They're actually going to hire two more reps. So we went from two salespeople to eight people that we taught, and they're now selling our product. So they've taken us 100 to 200. We just signed with Straub, Anheuser-Busch in Orange County, LA. Now we went from two people, me and Corey, and then we added Shannon on our team, helping us out. We have other people helping us. Seven more reps. Now Straub added 57 more people selling our product. So we're going to go teach them. We're going to grow. Now we share the money. We're a high value ticket for the distributor. They make a lot of profit of ours. And then
I've got some questions to ask about that. So yes. People hate this example when I use it, but years and years ago, I think I told one of you, I interviewed John Casella from Yellowtail and the then managing director. And they told me that one of the reasons it was so successful is they built the margins so that everybody who touched it would make money. How have you sort of thought about that, or what's your approach?
Oh my gosh. We've been thinking about this problem for like 15 years. The biggest problem was getting it on the shelf without going broke, right? So, I did it again. Let me ask you, because I already wanted to say, ask the question again.
Can I just say to everyone listening, it's 8 p.m. my time and I am on the ball. I'm not losing my train of thought because talking about how you build margins into.
Yes, sorry. So we start at the end point first. You start at the customer, and we had to make a certain level of wine that was going to be Dow, Sonoma Cutrer, Prisoner, that type of style, Justin. Then we had to look at the gross and net margin, the promotion margins that they do in those accounts, and then come back and do it to the distributor and come back and do it ourselves. So that's why we feel like using the can, going non-vintage, and then going the footprint that we are has saved us a lot of costs that we can just reinvest in the wine. So yeah, we started literally at the customer and we built it all the way backwards to us. And then if we couldn't do those things, we wouldn't have done it.
Okay. So my next question is, you've talked a number of times in this conversation about how difficult people find the wine category and how scary and complicated it is.
Yes.
What do you do in terms of getting people over that? Is it wine education? Do you say, don't worry about it? What's your approach?
No, that's it. So I think we said first principles. If we could make really great wine, how would we get it to people? Can was the vessel. And then for us, the counter service restaurants. I think the wine people really went premium and went luxury with wine. It's all this imagery of the vineyard and fancy places and boats. And our thing is just great wine, no rules. And wine on its own, it's naturally low carb and low sugar. There's this big movement against chemicals and artificial sweeteners. And wine is just sitting there saying, hey, look at me. I've been natural the whole time. So what we're doing is saying, from the customer side, we're making better wine more accessible. From the messaging side, it's like great wine, no rules. Have it with your favorite takeout food. Have it on the beach. Have it on the patio. Drink it out of a can. But don't make it so expensive everywhere.
One of the things I find really interesting, and I've asked a lot of people this, I've asked a lot of beverage analysts about this, is that wine drinking is collapsing, but where it's collapsing fastest is at the most value affordable end, which you think if there's a cost of living crisis, people would you know, go for those wines. But other people say, well, the wines at that end have become so boring because premiumization moved the interesting wines up. So I don't really know. What's your opinion about this? Like, what's happened at that affordable kind of end, do you think?
There shouldn't have been that many layers of wine. There's like four layers on each shelf. There's 500 to 7,000 wines in a lot of the supermarkets and stores here, but it's really six companies. So just imagine they've built all these walls and layers of wine that weren't really good and people wanted to be into it. All the rich people are doing it. I wanted to try wine. That consumer's fading. And the truth is that is like the power Sutter Home user is just aging out of drinking that product. And so that's taking their...
Well, that's the other theory I've heard, that these entry-level products haven't changed and they were really for the baby boomer, and so they haven't moved to new sort of, you know, gateway or gate opener products. Corey, what do you think about this? What's your opinion?
I look at it like as far as us, like, you know, some of those products that were single serve that have been around, like, no wine drinker is actually going to drink them. So it's just we're right. dealing with a whole new slew of consumers.
Oh, yeah.
And we've just gone about it with the same way. So it's like everybody's like saying the wine industry's broken. So it's like quit trying the same things. So, you know, yes. for us, it was, I mean, Zeke said it earlier, it's like starting with the customer. Nobody does that. Nobody does that, or else there wouldn't be so much shitty wine. Start with the customer and work backwards. And now I'm rambling.
No, okay. My next question is, what do you think beer distributors understand that people in wine just don't get?
So I don't look at it like it's necessarily something they get. I look at it as something that's more entrenched with their network and where they are and where they go. Because if, you know, at least here in the United States, there's a huge kind of reckoning happening with the distribution system. It's all being disrupted, where, like I said before, it was so bifurcated with beer and then wine and spirits. Where now all the big wine and spirit brands, and, you know, we don't need to go into why now unless you would like to, but it's like you're seeing all these, you know, legacy big, you know, wine and spirit brands now going to more traditional beer distributors. And now the wine and spirit guys are like, oh, we should probably have beer too. So it's just, it's about the customer. And so many customers, are at these smaller restaurants, especially with inflation, you know, the increase in like robotics, innovation,
yes.
inflation, it's almost impossible. As you know, you will see, you know, the full service traditional restaurants, they're going to decline like crazy. There'll always be a place for them, but they're everything is moving towards, just being more efficient, and the counter service kind of model provides that. And so,
yeah. Okay, so one of the things that happens in downturns like this, particularly in the wine trade, is that there's a glut of amazing grapes on the market and you can make wine that is just over the top for the price. But one day the glut is over. So have you planned for what will happen when the amazing grapes and wine isn't as available as it is now?
Yeah, we have. That's a great question. You know, our winemaker, Gerardo, is a farmer first. They came over as farmers, growers. They got land before he became a winemaker. So we have his family vineyards and all of his relationships that they've cultivated over 67 years. And our style is, we hope that every time you grab those Cuernos, you don't have to think about what food, what sauce. It's going to be fresh and it's going to be the style that you like. So that's going to affect everybody else. Like eventually, yeah, this cheap grape stuff's not going to be available anymore. But the way we do it, we just have a lower cost basis on headcount and operating costs.
And Felicity, because we went non-vintage and non-appellated, we have, you know, even though Gerardo's from Lodi, our red wines are, you know, at this point, Petite Syrah driven from Lodi specifically, but we don't behold him to Lodi. If that makes sense. So it's like, so whether he's growing it, whether he's sourcing it, blending it, aging it, whatever it is, we just give him freedom. And so I believe that'll bode well as we expand.
So where are you now in terms of volume? What are you doing?
So I think this year, some good news, we ended up signing with Anheuser-Busch, and we had to do another production run, kind of an emergency run in September, and we're set up for December. So I think we will do about 15,000 cases this year. And if you wanted me to say the number, I think we'll do 50 to 70,000 cases next year, which is an aggressive growth plan.
But so you are actually growing exponentially. That's you know, when companies grow that fast, it's actually the most stressful bit is the point of growth, because then you have to start finding new suppliers. You have to pay them before you get paid, all of those things. Are you finding that you're at that stress point? And if so, how are you handling it?
You know, man, you really do know. So there's this joy that we have a formula that works, but you're convincing everybody and it's hard. And you're like in this cycle of buying a bunch, selling a bunch, and buying a bunch. I think we're out of the cycle early January, but it's been a total meat grinder. I'm not going to lie. Because before we did this one, there was all this talk. And then we went from selling to worrying about running out in like a 2-week period.
Yeah. And that sounds like a problem that everyone wants, but actually that's a nightmare problem.
Yeah.
Well, we could not let some of our big customers. We have the Rady Shell, this big concert venue in downtown San Diego. We just picked up Snapdragon Stadium. We have PayPal Park. So we're on the boards there.
So everyone the sees. Next problem that happens in situations like yours is when you've opened up an opportunity, a lot of other people go, oh, look, there's an opportunity. Have you experienced that? And if so, how are you going to defend yourself against other people going, huh, maybe we can do it with less good wine?
So I think our distributor experience and our experience getting sales reps and a distributor up to speed, being able to work within their frameworks. And what we say, make them money, be easy to work with, and then teach people. So by doing that, other people don't have that. Like, we worked all channels of the business. When we talk to a restaurant customer and we show the distributor, ask him how many customers he gets a day. Oh, I'm a counter, so I get 500 a day. Tell him if he gets 80 more units of red wine, how much more money he can make. So we're selling wine off profit and customer, not off terroir and stuff that we're going to lose, and it's going to be complicated. So if they come for us, I'm okay, because they're going to be in the same distributor house.
Like, if they come for us, we're ready for them. Okay, final thoughts. We've got a couple of minutes left. What haven't we covered that you think is really important to talk about? You know, what's next for the brand?
Go first, Corey, because I've been hogging this.
Well, I want to level set and just say we're only in the San Diego market. We just launched into Orange County in LA, and this is just the beginning. So the fact that we are currently in the current issue of Wine Spectator, as you know, recommended, it's crazy to us. Like, they, you know, Aaron Romano, he reached out to us. So, you know, for us, you know, it's just about doing it, about expanding thoughtfully, and thankfully, with how the distribution system is, we have the opportunity to do that. As tempting as it is to sign a, you know, national distribution, we're not doing that. This is very strategic. We're going market by market. We're lighting intense fires and going deep. And so a lot of the problems kind of that you're referring to with scalability and all this stuff, a lot of it we have control over based on when and how we enter markets, if that makes sense. So, we're just going to do it what we feel is at the right cadence.
All right. So look, thank you very much for your time. It's been a great conversation. I can't wait to hear about what you do next. Thank you. Oh,
thank you so much, Felicity. This is awesome.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.